Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 64. My name's Terry Frost, and this time I'm doing a couple of relatively low-budget science fiction movies from 2015. You remember 2015. They're both a bit feminist. They're both interesting uses of the genre, and I enjoyed both of them, which is lovely after seeing other films recently. The first one is a 2015 science fiction film called Advantageous, directed by Jennifer Pong. And the second one is a much more widely known movie, which is 2015's Ex Machina, starring Domhnall Gleeson and Oscar Isaac, directed by Alex Garland. So both of them involve singularities of sorts. Both of them are really interesting, and both of them have something to say about female roles in society. So sit back, relax, grab yourself a drink and some spaceman ice cream, and I'll be back in a moment after I do the contact details with the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how's everybody going? We've settled back in domesticity after our time away on vacay, and the weather is shit, of course, in Melbourne because it's winter. Yes, I know it's not as bad as it is in the Northern Hemisphere, but from our point of view, it's a shitty winter. It's cold, it's damp, it's nasty, and the days are short. All of the things I don't particularly like about winter. If any billionaires are listening and they want to contribute a fair whack to the Patreon campaign, I'd be really happy to relocate all of the Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In services to Darwin. Sal would agree with me. And we can actually have some decent weather year-round, and you'll never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, have to listen to me bitch about the weather again on a podcast. Yes, I may bitch about whether it's wet or dry season, but I won't bitch about how cold it is again. So that's just a word out there. Billionaires, I'd say 400k would do it nicely and comfortably. More than happy to do that for you. So on that cheerful and money-grubbing note, it's been an interesting little while. The marriage equality debate is up and running in Australia, and the forces of evil, of course, are trying to stop it. So for any of my GTBLI and all the rest of them people listening, we are trying. We're trying to get things right here, and I apologise that we haven't so far. And I apologise that we're treating so many of our people and so many people in general as second-rate citizens in this country. They're not doing it with my approval. That's about as political as it's going to get this time around. Though there will be some gender politics talked about later when I talk about the two movies, Advantageous and Ex Machina. Both of which are very good. I've been trying to toss up in my mind which one's better, and I suppose it depends on your point of view. So now let's see, what have I been watching? I just did the high notes. I've seen a bit of shit, but there are a few that I want to talk about. I did see a really good Arthur Penn movie that's almost forgotten now, but it is quite fun to watch. And that is Little Big Man from 1970, starring Dustin Hoffman and Faye Dunaway. It's got some other interesting actors in it as well. Martin Balsam's in it, Jeff Corey's in it, a few others. And it's the story of Jack Crabb, who at the time is 121 years old and is the only surviving white person from Custer's Last Stand. It's a comedy. It's a kind of picturesque movie. It does give Native Americans a fair shake too, because Jack Crabb lives part of his life with Native American people in tribal situations. It's based on a novel by Thomas Berger, and it was a bit of fun. I picked it up really cheaply on Blu-ray. I think it was about $5, something like that. I remembered the movie from years ago, but didn't remember too much about it because I probably haven't seen it in 30 years. And it was fun to revisit. It really shows Dustin Hoffman having a bit of fun there. And I kind of, yeah, it's worth checking out. If you get a chance to see Little Big Man, definitely do so. It's definitely worth your time. Now, the other thing I picked up for a dollar less than that was when I was in Perth, I went through a few kind of junk shops and what the Americans call Goodwill stores, and picked up a copy of The Octagon, a Chuck Norris movie on Blu-ray for $4. And to be honest with you, I probably paid about $3.50 too much for it. I don't really understand the attraction of Chuck Norris, I'll be honest with you. The guy couldn't act his way out of a parking ticket. He moves well, but he's as stiff as a board. It's Chuck Norris versus ninjas, and they've got this really weird bit with echoey Chuck Norris voiceovers to kind of talk about his internal thought processes. So you hear the thoughts of the Chuck Norris character, which are very interesting. It's a standard kind of martial arts hero versus ninja kind of movie. No better than it has to be. I've got about 3/4 of the way through it, and I'm still tossing up whether I go all the distance. It does have Lee Van Cleef in it, which makes it a little more interesting. And it has a few romantic bits with Chuck Norris and women in it. And I don't know with Chuck Norris's personal situation, but on the screen he doesn't look like he's particularly into women. And, I may go back to that one. I may not. I'm just tossing up now. But I got it for $4, so I haven't really wasted much money on it. I've wasted more time than money watching that one. What else have I watched? I did see an interesting musical, which everyone's forgot about. It's a Sam Katzman one for Columbia Pictures in the 1950s, low-budget kind of thing. Sam Katzman did a whole bunch of films for Columbia at the time, some of which were kind of rock and roll movies. But he was hedging his bet with this one, and he wanted to see, he kind of played the movie like this music trend was going to defeat rock and roll and take over the mantle of rock and roll. It's from about 1957, and it's a movie called Calypso Heatwave. And it's got some interesting people in it. Joel Grey's in it in a very young role. Alan Arkin's in it in the folk group he was in the 1950s called the... I'm just trying to remember the name of the folk group. The Tarriers. He's in there. Maya Angelou's in there singing Calypso. A whole bunch of other people. And yeah, it's very, very 1950s. Some of the clothing's very 1950s. The cultural appropriation of Calypso music by white people is very much evident there, except, of course, when Maya Angelou's on the screen. But there's a really nice little dance number with Joel Grey jiving around and stuff like that. He's about 25 at the time, and he's playing a teenager. It's that kind of movie. But it says, the screen's first great Calypso musical. And it was a little bit of fun to watch that. It's fun to watch those 1950s rock and roll kind of musicals. At times you see people you don't see on the screen very much. And it's a little hard to find. You may have to kind of really search out to find a copy of Calypso Heatwave. But it wasn't a waste of my time. Now, speaking of wasting my time, I did see two Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, one of which was a waste of time, the other of which I'm kind of amused by. Now, Arnie's got this little thing going at the moment where he does big budget films and then he does little independent films where he's trying to show a little more acting chops. And one of them's that and one of them's a big budget film. The movie I saw where he's trying to show his acting chops is Maggie, where he plays a father whose daughter's been bitten by a zombie in a kind of almost post-apocalyptic world where the rule of law hasn't quite broken down yet and they're trying to manage the zombie outbreak. And his daughter, played by Abigail Breslin, has been bitten, so he goes to the city, gets her and brings her back to the farm to look after her and to nurse her and to do his fatherly duty. Now, basically, leaving aside Arnie and leaving aside the zombie stuff, here's what this movie is. Does anybody remember the old Disney film Old Yeller, where the dog gets rabies and the kid who owns it has to shoot it? This is basically Old Yeller with Abigail Breslin instead of a dog, where she's slowly getting sicker and sicker and more feral and more feral, and we know that Arnie is going to have to put a bullet in her at some stage. Turns out he doesn't. I mean, there's not. I'm not going to really do spoilers on it, but it turns out there's another ending there, which is kind of a nicer ending. But when you cut down to it and cut through all of the emotion, it's basically Old Yeller with zombies. No, I'm not trying to tell you not to see it. I think you should see it if you're that way inclined and if you're a zombie completist. But, yeah, that was the impression I was left with that. And then on the same day, I went out and saw Terminator Genisys, G-E-N-I-S-Y-S, where they try to reboot the Terminator franchise and end up doing a Terminator 3 with it, pretty much. Now, Arnie, even having said that he's trying to do the character roles a little more, he's very much a limited actor. And to make it work with him in any movie, even one like this, you've got to surround him with strong actors. And with the exception of J.K. Simmons, who has a kind of tacked-on role to show the other actors how to act, you don't really get strong actors surrounding Arnie. You get Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones playing Sarah Connor, and she is not very good at it. She doesn't have anywhere near the kind of determination and the toughness of Linda Hamilton playing the same role back in the 1980s and early 1990s, I think it was. She's very short, and it's kind of like a little girl trying to play tough. You get that kind of play toughness about her. Not very good. Then you get Australian actor Joe Courtney playing the love interest and the father of John Connor, Kyle Reese. And Jai Courtney, who was in, I think, the fourth or fifth Die Hard movie, I think it might have been the fifth Die Hard movie, playing John McClane's son, just doesn't have the chops for that. He's a television-level actor, and they put him in a movie role where he's supposed to play the charismatic love interest, tough guy, action hero. And I'm not sure what's wrong with his face, but it doesn't seem to convey human expression. And that's unfortunate. Yes, he does look cut when he takes his clothes off, as you need to do to time travel in the Terminator universe. But I'm not sure he has too much else working for him there. I hope that his acting chops get better for his sake and for the sake of his career. But at this stage, it's not at the level that you need things. They reference the first Terminator movie in a kind of like rubbing a rabbit's foot for good luck. And I'm not sure that this movie is anything but a cash cow. It's not made out of any passion. It's not made out of any great need to continue the story. It's made purely for the bucks. And that definitely shows. There's a thing by Matt Smith in the movie, the former Doctor Who. Basically, he's in there as a bit of stunt casting. He gets really fuck all to do, except stand in front of a green screen for half of the film, or the half of the bits that he is in the film. You could have had almost anybody playing that. It really is a movie that is, the dialogue is really shit. I really think that, because basically you've got people across a wide range of things. You've got Arnie playing an aged Terminator. You've got Sarah Connor from the 1980s. You've got Kyle Reese from the future. You've also got John Connor, who is played by an actor called Jason Clarke, who, like Jai Courtney, is an Australian. And it looks like we've thrown every bad Australian actor possible into this movie. I mean, he has starred in a number of other things. He was in Zero Dark Thirty. He was in The Great Gatsby. He was in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and other things. But to be honest with you, his skill level isn't where it needs to be to play John Connor. To play a strong role, you need somebody who's not just going to play it like a corporate executive gone bad. And Jason Clarke just doesn't do that. It's really unfortunate that, yeah, we have better actors. We do have better actors in Australia. I mean, one of the things I like about Chris Hemsworth as an actor is that Chris Hemsworth always seems to be enjoying the act of acting. He kind of always has that slight playfulness. It doesn't matter what he's doing. He's got that enthusiasm that really makes a top-level star. and that kind of passion for it. Yes, he's a very attractive man, and he's cut when he needs to be cut, but he also has a kind of joie de vivre that these two actors singularly lack. And that's one of the unfortunate things. One of the things we like about big stars is that they seem to be enjoying themselves, even in a serious role. You can see that there's a certain enthusiasm, a certain passion. And that passion doesn't come across with either Jai Courtney or Jason Clarke, which is unfortunate there. So Terminator Genisys, yes, people are going to see it and the fanboys are going to squee. And all of the nods and the kind of going back into the past of the first movie and changing things around is going to get a lot of that kind of emotional wee from a lot of people. But to be honest with you, it's kind of like the last Die Hard movie. It really is. Why the fuck did they do it? Which is unfortunate because I think Terminator is an interesting franchise and has some interesting but not particularly deep things to say. But nonetheless, I went and saw it on a rainy Saturday morning and I kind of wish I hadn't. I saw it in 2D. I don't think 3D would have added anything to it that was worthwhile. Now, there are two other movies I want to talk about that I've watched. The first one is a thriller from 1955 called Black Widow, which has an interesting cast. It's got Van Heflin in it, who I recently saw in the first Airport movie. It has Ginger Rogers in it. It has Gene Tierney and a bunch of other people. George Raft's in it. And it's basically about a murder case among rich people in Hollywood. But it's filmed beautifully in CinemaScope. It's the kind of thing that would make a TV movie these days because they don't do murder mysteries as feature films these days unless they've got a real big, high concept backing to them. But this is old school stuff and it's a murder mystery. Who killed the girl who ostensibly committed suicide in the theatrical producer's apartment? And I enjoyed it. I mean, it was a lot of fun seeing the actors do their stuff, seeing Van Heflin in a role very different from the one he played in Airport, the 1970 Airport movie. And, it's not too bad at all. I really kind of like that old-school Hollywood now and then, particularly after I'd just seen Terminator Genisys. I wanted to clear my palate with something a bit different. The other thing I've seen, which is a documentary of the Newport Jazz Festival in 1955, and it's Jazz on a Summer's Day, which is beautifully, the America's Cup yachting was on at the same time as the Jazz Festival, and they use a lot of the yacht racing stuff as background to the music, as well as doing it in the documentary. They use a lot of the people who are at the festival, so they do a lot of cross-cutting to people smoking cigarettes and popping their fingers and clicking their fingers and young people dancing to the music. They've got a really great ensemble. Louis Armstrong's in there singing with Jack Teagarden. You've got Anita O'Day there. You've got Mahalia Jackson, Dinah Washington, Ornette Coleman, tons and tons of really good jazz musicians at the time. But the cross-cutting and the editing is really fantastic. You see people staggering around drunk the morning after the concert. You see people drinking and smoking and dancing with each other. And it's just a lovely doco. You can have it on in the background and just listen to the music if you want to, but the visuals do really work. Putting some of the music, particularly the kind of very abstract jazz, against the scenes of the yacht race, shot from above, from a helicopter, I assume, or a small aeroplane, really do make it a very, very groovy experience. And it's one of the best jazz documentaries of the 20th century. I really recommend Jazz on a Summer's Day, and it was really nice to revisit that again. So that's about it for what I've been watching. I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about, I've kind of decided which is the lesser of the two movies. And in this case, it's going to be Ex Machina, the Alex Garland written and directed movie starring Domhnall Gleeson and Oscar Isaac.
How long until we get to his estate?
We've been flying over his estate for the past 2 hours.
Caleb, I'm just going to throw this out there so it's said, okay? You're freaked out. You're freaked out to be meeting me, having this conversation in this room at this moment, right? But can we just get past that? The whole employer-employee thing?
It's good to meet you, Nathan.
It's good to meet you too, Ken. This building isn't a house. research facility. And I want to talk to you about what I'm researching. You want to see something cool? You are dead center of the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
Hello.
Hi. Do you have a name?
Ava.
Answer me this. How do you feel about her?
Her AI is beyond doubt.
No, nothing analytical. Just how do you feel?
I feel that she's amazing.
Good.
Do you want to be my friend?
Of course.
Will it be possible?
Why would it not be?
Did you know that Nathan brought me here to test you?
You're wrong.
Wrong about what?
Nathan, you shouldn't trust anything he says.
Does Ava actually like you? Or is she just pretending to like you? Self-awareness, manipulation, sexuality.
Are you attracted to me?
Now, if that isn't true AI, what is?
Caleb, there's something I want to show you.
Can we talk about the lies you've been spinning me?
What lies?
Today, I'm going to test you.
Why me?
Caleb. You have to help me.
What was the real test? You.
Is it strange to have made something that hates you? What will happen to me if I fail your test?
Ex Machina is a 2015 British science fiction thriller written and directed by Alex Garland, and I'm reading this off Wikipedia. Making his directorial debut, the film stars Domhnall Gleeson, Alicia Vikander, and Oscar Isaac. Ex Machina tells the story of a programmer who is invited by his employer to administer the Turing test to an android with artificial intelligence. So that's basically, it's a fairly simple story at the surface of things, but becomes a more complex one as we find out what's actually going on, and what we think's going on at the start, of course, is not what is actually going on. Domhnall Gleeson, who's Brendan Gleeson's son, plays a programmer called Caleb, who works for Blue Book, which is basically the Google of this universe. He visits the really remote home / research facility of the company's CEO, Nathan, who is played by Oscar Isaac, who people might remember from the recent Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewyn Davis. He was very, very good in that. That's a film I recommend as well. But both him and Domhnall Gleeson are going to be in the new Star Wars movie, which probably means they're going to become very famous and hopefully will at some stage live it down. But this movie, Alicia Vikander is very good in this movie, playing Ava, the android. She actually trained in a ballet school, so she's got the kind of poise and the ability to control her body that a ballet dancer has. In fact, she's going to be in the new Guy Ritchie version of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie, which will star Armie Hammer and Henry Cavill. The school she trained in as a ballet dancer was the Royal Swedish Ballet School. She's done a lot of acting roles since then, but nothing particularly distinguished, but she's incredibly good in this. In a very difficult role as well. It's not an easy role to pretend to be a machine that is trying to be human, but she does a great job of it. The only other character of note in the movie is played by an actress called Sonoya Mizuno, and she plays Kyoko, who is Nathan's assistant, who doesn't speak any English and is basically there to run the household for him. Sonoya Mizuno also trained as a ballet dancer at the Royal Ballet School in England. So the two female characters in this movie are both played by people with ballet training for not unreasonable reasons. It's going to be a little hard to avoid spoilers when I'm talking about this film, but I'm going to do it because I don't want to do the reveals that are there, but I want to kind of elliptically allude to them. in order to say what I need to say about the movie. Now, if that makes me sound mysterious or kind of uncommitted to what I'm saying, I'm sorry, but that's how I'm going to have to handle this one, because it's like the other movie, Advantageous. There are things about the film that it's better that I don't say. Not because they're rosebud kind of revelations, but because they're important for people to see in the continuum of the film. They're part of the process of getting from A to B in the film. And I really don't want to kind of ruin it for people in doing that. That's the problem with revealing films that people don't know. But Caleb, Donald Gleason's character, is a kind of naive guy. He's in his mid-20s. He's a talented programmer, but he's not right at the top end of things. He knows about the Turing test. He can speak knowledgeably about it. He can speak knowledgeably about AI because he did a semester about AI in his university education. He's smart. He's a bit of a loner. He doesn't have a girlfriend. And in the sense, because of what's expected of him by Nathan, he is the perfect person to test Ava, the AI, with the Turing test. So the movie is built around 7 encounters between Ava and Caleb, going from the first one when they first meet through to the 7th one, which ends interestingly. Let's put it that way. And in between are conversations between Nathan and Caleb about Ava the AI and about other things as well. Come to think of it, there is a kind of subgenre of recent science fiction which involves men sexualizing technology. There's Her, the movie with Joaquin Phoenix and the voice of Scarlett Johansson in there. There are a few others as well. There's a real kind of thing where male sexuality is viewed and examined in movies through the lens of science fiction. And that's kind of interesting in a way. And it does, in most of these examples, with the possible exception of Her, kind of deconstructs male sexuality in a way, and a certain kind of male sexuality, the kind of selfish, entitled male sexuality that causes a lot of the problems that our societies have. And this movie is one of those. Without doing too much of a spoiler, Nathan, the billionaire genius character in this movie, takes sexualizing technology to new limits. Let's just put it that way. And that's not particularly a spoiler, because there are other aspects to the film as well that are more important than that. But the character of Nathan, really well played by Oscar Isaac, is the kind of entitled billionaire. If somebody starts taking a conversation in a direction he doesn't want, he interrupts them and kind of supersedes them and makes the conversation go the way he wants. He does that to Caleb at least 3 or 4 times during the movie, where he takes total control of anything they discuss because he's a much more important person and he only has time for the things that he wants to talk about. And yeah, I can see that. I've dealt with 1 or 2 very wealthy people in my time. In fact, I had a conversation with a guy that's worth at least $20 million not 2 weeks ago. And there is that kind of ability to direct a conversation, not in the rude and abrupt way that Nathan does, but wealthy people have a way of steering the conversation where they want it to go. It's a skill they pick up for whatever reasons, particularly very important wealthy people. There are unimportant wealthy people, there are any number of them, but it's just an interesting process that happens with that kind of person. And you see it a lot in politicians as well. One of the nice things about having and I'm getting back to politics again, but I apologize. One of the nice things about having a kind of free and open media is you can see that entitlement and that sense of this is where I want this conversation to go being challenged. And it's an interesting approach to take, and it's an interesting to see how politicians handle that challenge in individual circumstances. They all handle it slightly differently, but the way that they handle impertinent questions is a reflection of character. And Nathan's character in this movie is revealed by the way he handles Caleb's conversation and the kind of abrupt way he takes it where he wants it to go. That reveals a lot about his character. And in fact, when you first see Nathan, he's doing a very butch and macho thing. He's out there with a heavy punching bag, getting some exercise and talking about how he drinks too much and then he has to do penance on by doing exercise afterwards. So we know that Nathan's an alcoholic. We know he's incredibly brilliant. He would have to be to create an artificially intelligent android. But he is a very flawed character and one who has deliberately isolated himself from other human beings because he may well have personality issues. And as the movie moves on, we learn a little bit more about that. We learn a little bit more about why he's in the situation he is and who he is and what he wants from this project, which is, you know, it's a singularity kind of project, an artificially intelligent creature that we can't tell whether it's actually intelligent or not, whether it's aware or not. But the people involved, two men who, in each in their own way, are very flawed, are kind of trying to understand something which may be a lot more intelligent to them or may have the resources to make better decisions than them. One of the things Ava has as a quality of her character in the movie, and I'll talk about her for a little bit, is the ability to read micro expressions and interpret them. And in her conversations with Caleb, she does act as a lie detector. There is a kind of question and answer session where she detects lies, but the limitation to that being she doesn't know when what the truth is until he tells her the truth. She knows when he's telling things that aren't true, but she doesn't know when he's telling the truth, except through micro-expressions. And micro-expressions are those kind of momentary things. If you do a really slow-mo camera on somebody when they're talking, you get micro-expressions which kind of show the underlying thought processes and can be used as a kind of form of lie detector. And Ava has a native ability to use that, but she also has a number of other abilities which are more subtly portrayed in the movie as well. And and the lovely thing about Alicia Vikander's playing of the character is, if you watch it very closely, and I recommend that you do, there's a subtlety to the acting that shows her to be intelligent and, yes, attractive, even though she's only partly humanoid and there's a lot of mechanics showing in her body language and her facial expressions. And Alicia Vikander does have a wonderfully expressive face. You can see why these men are attracted to her, but because of the subtlety of the acting, if you look very closely, you can also see why they shouldn't. There's a subtle manipulative talent to this android, which ultimately does lead to a kind of breakout ending. And that's one of the things I really like about the film. I like the way that Alex Garland, who had previously written a number of movies, he did that thing, The Island, for instance, with Leonardo DiCaprio. And he wrote both 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, for instance. He did the screenplay for Sunshine and Never Let Me Go and Dread. So he's very much a genre writer. And this is a theme that he was been interested in for a very long time. Ever since he was very young, he wanted to make a movie about artificial intelligence, ever since he saw things like 2001 at an early age. But he really nails it with this one in a lot of ways. It's a movie that I have only seen it once, but I'm going to see it again because it's a movie that kind of benefits from repeat viewing. You can see the kind of signposts for what occurs later in the movie at various times during the film. And that's always fun to revisit. It's a movie with that kind of complexity in the acting. It's a simple plot, basically. Guy goes to visit a reclusive billionaire and test his android on a kind of modified version of the Turing test. And that's as simple as it gets. But the subtlety is in the dialogue. The dialogue is very good. The dialogue was so fucking refreshing after I watched Terminator Genesis. Just hearing dialogue that's this good and acted this well was a real refreshment after watching that movie. And it's in the dialogue and it's also in the acting. The acting is very subtle. Even Nathan, it can be an over-the-top bombastic character, is very well played by Oscar Isaac. He watches people very closely, but you don't know what he's thinking. And that's something that's not that easy to portray as an actor. And Isaac has that particular gift of intelligent appraisal while being opaque. And it's used to very good effect here. He's a shorter actor than Donald Gleason, but he's portrayed and acted as a much more muscular and the kind of dominant character. And his dominance and his kind of outright male sweaty sexuality is a challenge to the Caleb character in some ways. And it's kind of like he decides that what he wants to do is, what Caleb decides is he wants to rescue Ava from this beast of a man who created her. In the sense, there's a little bit of Frankenstein in here as well. Ava could be seen as a bride of Frankenstein kind of character, but there's also Coppelia in there. There's a whole bunch of different influences in this movie. And it does bring up questions of, can you... Well, I won't go further than saying just what I'm going to say now. Can you sexually harass and sexually abuse a machine? That's an important question in this movie for various reasons. And the answers depend on whether you believe that the machine is intelligent, whether the machine is sentient, or whether it's something that just imitates sentience. But whether it is or not, the fact that somebody is trying to sexually abuse a machine in this movie and sexually use and kind of form some kind of sexual slavery with a machine in this movie, she says it's wrong for the simple fact that somebody's trying to do it. It's not wrong whether the machine's intelligent and sentient being or not. It's wrong because a human being is trying to do this. And that's something that kind of informs the ending of the movie in a way. It's not necessarily about the character of Ava. It's about the male characters and male entitlement to a certain extent. And there's always that argument when these kind of movies, any movie that's got an AI in it, we never get a satisfactory and fully kind of unambiguous answer to the question of whether it's intelligent or not. There's always that doubt there. There's always a yes, it is because I want it to be. No, it isn't because I want it to be. The audience's own kind of tendencies in one direction or the other makes it, gives you an answer. But in any of these movies, you're never going to get an unambiguous answer. You don't get one in 2001. You don't get one in any other movie with AI in it that is it really intelligent or is it just pretending to be or is it imitating and is it kind of creatively imitating a genuinely intelligent being? Really hard one to answer. It's a question that many, many, many very, very brilliant scientists from Ray Kurzweil onwards are trying to answer. But just to wrap it up for Ex Machina, it's a good movie. It's on a small budget. It costs 13 million euro, which is nothing, and it made twice the money back so far. But if you like intelligent, thoughtful science fiction, this is definitely one to go with. And it's contrasts nicely with Advantageous in the sense that this is things seen from a male point of view. You've got a male writer-director. The two strongest characters in the movie are male. So you see kind of the singularity and the path to the future through male eyes in this one, whereas in Advantageous, it's overwhelmingly from a female viewpoint. So these ones match up really nicely together. It's a strong film. It's very well acted by all parties concerned, and it's worth checking out. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the less well-known of these two films, Advantageous, directed by Jennifer Pong and starring Jacqueline Kim and James Urbaniak.
Okay, so who out there has an imagination? Everyone. Okay, everyone, close your eyes. Imagine a world where you are diagnosed with a terminal illness. But you live to see your great-grandkids go to college. Now let's imagine living 40 dreary years with a club foot. But on your 50th birthday, you're a professional ballet dancer. Now open your eyes. That world is here, and it's yours.
Advantageous is a 2015 American science fiction movie based on a TV episode from a TV series called Future States from 2013. The four main actors in this, and again, like the other film I've talked about in this podcast, it's got a very small cast in a sense. The four actors remain the same between the TV series and the feature film version, which is on Netflix, by the way. It's on Netflix in Australia. It's on Netflix in the US as well. And I recommend that you watch it. So the main character, Gwen, is played by Jacqueline Kim, an Asian-American actor who is really, really good in it. She's the mother of a gifted child called Jules, played by Samantha Kim. And this is set in a future 2041, according to the original TV episode. Unemployment rate is 45%. There are ongoing terrorist acts around the city. Seeing explosions is not an unusual thing in this world. And the employment situation means that, of course, the economy is tanking to a certain extent, while at the same time, some incredible technologies are coming on board. Now, Gwen is the representative of a company involved in this biotech revolution. She's the spokesperson for the company, but there are some problems with it. The company's trying to market to different demographics now, and her as a middle-aged Asian woman doesn't have the right look for the company. Her boss, played by James Urbaniak, tells her this. His name's Fisher, and he's very good in the movie as well. There isn't a bad bit of acting there, so we'll just assume that anybody I talk about is good in the film. Now, Urbaniak I know from a lot of things. In fact, he's the voice of Dr. Venture, amongst other things, in the bugfuck crazy TV series The Venture Brothers. But in this, he has a serious role, and he gives a very nuanced performance in it. He's a man trapped in a corporate web, in a sense. He and Gwen have a friendship and perhaps a previous relationship as well. And they do have a certain rapport, but the needs of the company come first. Now, before I go any further talking about the plot, I'm going to play a bit from the original TV episode. I've got some audio from that, which explains how Gwen is going to deal with the dilemma of the fact that her employment is being terminated and she hasn't been able to get Jules into one of the magnet schools, one of the free schools that will allow her to have a future in this futuristic, somewhat dystopian world. And so she has to get enough money to send her to a private school. This is a holographic conversation between the two of them and goes to the heart of the story.
Sorry. Have you been?
Am I too old to be of use?
What are you talking about, Gwen?
So many women are out of work. Some of them are in real trouble.
To be frank, there is talk among recruiters about letting women stay unemployed, and the perception is it's safer than putting millions of desperate men on the street.
Safer? For whom?
Everyone.
Make me the younger candidate.
I'm sorry.
The procedure you're launching, use it on me. Put me into a younger body.
You don't want this. We haven't had any civilian test subjects yet.
I want to be the face of the center again. I've done all the prep work already. I'd be both an expert and a user, your ideal spokesperson.
Can we talk about this later? I really need to do this later.
I can't get an interview, Dave. Not one.
I really have to go.
I have to position Jules now. If I can get her into a good school, she'll have a chance. I can't let her become one of these women so desperate that they would do anything. Dave, you would do the same for your own girls if you were in my place.
Marketing has a specific physical type in mind. They're looking at candidates that come off as a touch more universal. If I could tell them that you'd be willing to give them full control over the creation of your host body, that might show them how much you care about the product's success.
Okay.
You'd be willing to do that? Sign over full control. Are you sure?
The point is to push the product, right?
When isn't it?
So the technology they're talking about in that clip, which I love, it goes right to the guts of it, is a way of downloading a person's mind into a new body. And Gwen allows the company to do that. And there's more to it than that. Of course, there's more to it than that. Because then the problem comes, can she still relate to her daughter when she is in the new body? And there are some medical conditions that go along with this transfer as well. The new clone bodies have breathing difficulties and need to have injections every 2 hours, and emergency injections should they have an attack of the breathing problems going. And there is recurring pain. There's chronic pain involved with this as well. So there are some not insignificant downsides to this procedure, apart from the obvious ones. But the big issue for Gwen is, can Jules relate to her? Now, the day before the procedure takes place, two things happen. One of which is she gets to have Christmas with her daughter, which is an incredibly sweet moment, and cements our understanding of the relationship between Gwen and Jules. And she also has a meeting with Fisher on a dock away from any surveillance equipment, which is used for a couple of purposes, one of which is it's very important to the plot of the film, and another is there's some unemployed women around, one's sleeping on a bench, one's fishing off the wharf, and kind of has a kind of blank, hostile stare. So the background of the film does show us both sides of things. There are the incredible wealthy and privileged people, and there are people who are doing it hard. There's a woman living in a large pot planter in the outside of Gwen's building, and she gives her food, and they have a whispered conversation at one stage. And there, you know, it's a world where technological change is having a major impact negatively on the planet, in a sense. As the TV episode it's based on says, it's 2041. There are 10 billion people in the world. There are no public schools, and all of the education is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics based. And so older people are being phased out by technological redundancy out of the workforce. And the reason why Gwen has a job is because she's very good at being the voice of this company. She does her homework. She has poise. She has intelligence. She's a great communicator. But as the movie progresses, she doesn't look right for their demographic. And that's where the crux of it is. This place is chews people up, uses them when it's right for them. It's a bit like a media or even being an actress or an actor. You go for jobs, and if you don't have the right look, you don't get them. Doesn't matter how talented you are, how dedicated, how focused, how good your toolkit is. It's a hard gig. I know several actors, and it's a hard gig to get a gig. And this parallels that, but on a much, much larger scale. Getting any kind of gig is nearly impossible. There are some implications of child prostitution. There are homelessness issues. And as the conversation with Fisher that I just played indicates, the unemployment skews unfairly towards women because they don't want a whole bunch of starving, homeless men on the streets. They believe that women are a more acceptable to society body of unemployed people to have out there. And that's a nasty edge to this world. Now, the other part of the movie and the episode itself are that Jennifer Pong and Jacqueline Kim, and most of the characters are Asian Americans. And while that isn't played up particularly, it does kind of three-dimensionalize the family issues, the importance of family, the sacrifice they make for family. Now, Gwen is alienated from her own family because of something that occurred in the past with the father of Jules. And there's a phone conversation that she has with her mother, who's a religious nut, basically. Her father hasn't forgiven her for what happened that caused Jules' birth. Her mother starts going all religious nutty on her during the phone conversation, which is an audio phone conversation, not a holographic one. And Gwen eventually cuts contact, but then goes to speak to her sister, who runs the family restaurant along with her brother-in-law Han, who's played by Ken Jeong. Ken Jeong's an actor that we see in much more broadly comedic roles usually. He played Leslie Chow in the Hangover movies, for instance. But in this, he's very good. It's not a large role, but it is a very nuanced one. It is a very well-played one. And he is very good in it. And this is something I really like seeing. And Urbaniak's the same thing. You've got actors that have got enormous skill sets. And we know them from humorous and frivolous things. We know James Urbaniak mostly from The Venture Brothers, which is great fun and a really nice bit of voice acting. We know Ken Jeong playing Leslie Chow, the crazy drug-crazed moron in the Hangover movies. And then we see them in roles like this. And we go, ah. And then you go back and watch or listen to, in the case of Urbaniak, their more comedic roles. And you see the craft that they bring to even those. And that's part of the fun of digging deeply into movies and digging deeply into media. Seeing these wonderful people with wonderful skills and who aren't appreciated enough sometimes for what they do. There's an easy way to dismiss the Leslie Chow character as just a two-dimensional Asian gangster, crazy, bugfuck idiot. But there's a lot of cool stuff that Ken Jeong does in that. I watched a couple of clips from the Hangover movies after I saw this film. And yeah, he does have acting chops beyond anything. He's actually a qualified doctor as well. His wife's a doctor. But he's chosen acting as a kind of second career. And I like him in this. I really like Jacqueline Kim as well. She brings a gravitas and a desperation and incredible subtlety to the role. The character of Gwen's in a situation where showing her anguish and showing her anger and showing her frustration and showing her fear isn't socially acceptable in the world she's in, particularly when she's talking to Fisher, when she's talking to a recruitment officer who turns out to be a computer program rather than a human being, and when she's talking to the mothers who whose children will be going to the same school that she'll have Jules in. There's a depth of character shown in those roles. It's in the subtlety. It's not a kind of acting that draws attention to itself, but it's acting that's very grounded and very emotion-based without being emotionally demonstrative. And that takes this to a new level. Now, I took a look at the Rotten Tomatoes for Advantageous, and I found something very interesting, and I don't know how indicative this is of anything, but I'll just put it out there. There's, of course, the positive and the negative reviews in Rotten Tomatoes. There's the green splattered tomatoes, which are negative reviews, well, more negative than positive reviews. And there are the red tomato ones, which are more positive reviews. And there are about 8 or 10 reviews for Advantageous up there, professional ones. The negative ones tend to be from men who say that the movie's slow and ponderous. And though they admire what Jennifer Pong's doing, they say it's slow and ponderous and the dialogue's heavy and things like that. But I don't think so. I think there's more to it than that. I think that that's a kind of shallow reading of what's going on in this film. And by the way, if I've got Jacqueline Pong and Jennifer Kim's names mixed up anywhere when I'm talking about this movie, I apologize. It's my limitations as a gaijin, I suppose. But this movie I really liked. It's refreshing. I mean, I watch a lot of shallow films. I watch a lot of films that aren't any better than they have to be. I watch a lot of films with spectacular explosions and rockets zooming around and things like that. It's part of what I watch. But when I see movies like this, which take that genre, I love science fiction, and use it to talk about family, and use it to talk about mothers and daughters, and use it to talk about how they may be impacted by technological and social change, and still take me along as a white middle-aged guy, then I set up a notice, and I really want to put the word out there that this is something people should watch. I really believe that. Now, it's a very feminist movie, of course, and I'm a feminist, though. I do, as a white middle-aged man, have my training wheels on. Nonetheless, I liked this film a lot. I liked it more than I liked Ex Machina, which talks about the darker side of male sexuality to a certain extent. And it shows me how people with different life experiences than me think. And it shows me how strong, and one of the things the movie demonstrates wonderfully is how strong the mother-child bond is. Now, I've seen it with my sister and my nephew Billy. I kind of have that visceral experience of it. In my own case, it was truncated by the fact that my father got custody of my brother and I when I was at a young age. So I don't have, in that sense, kind of a deep first-hand knowledge of this. But I can recognize it when I see it, and I can be in awe of it when I see it. I saw it when I was hanging out with my friend Alyssa in Perth and her child Mac. I saw the kind of bond between them, and I like that. It's, as I said, it's not part of my life experience, but I have great respect for it in others. And this movie, having a science fiction movie set in a kind of middle future, middle of the century future, which is about that, and which is about choices that are made for to help the next generation, totally selflessly, totally unselfishly, and made with a lot of love, then I like that in a film. I don't think I could stand watching many of them, because it is an emotionally grueling experience in some ways. But I think it's something we should be talking about this as much as we talk about war with science fiction, as much as we talk about adventure, as much as we talk about superheroes and other things. There's room in the genre for this kind of subtle, low-key, but very, very rewarding kind of film. And again, this is one of the problems we have with the Sad Puppies. They assume that science fiction can only be one particular subset of science fiction, and that that's the only stuff that's worth our attention and worth our regard. And that isn't the case. There's a lot more out there, and there's a lot out there that can teach us things, can make us feel emotion, which is something that way too many movies don't do these days. My pulse did not go up one beat when I was watching Terminator Genesis, for instance. But I think that one of the things I like about having Netflix now, we've only had it for a few months in Australia, is that it does showcase this kind of film and gives an audience to this kind of film. To whatever extent it does that. There are algorithms that Netflix use regarding film. And yeah, if you like science fiction, then you'll like this, all that kind of stuff. And this movie wasn't coming up on my Netflix queue as a suggestion. But because I've watched it now, I'm going to get more movies coming up on my suggested queue that have this kind of intelligence and this kind of heart. And that's great for me. I mean, I don't mind being pushed out of my comfort zone. In fact, some of the best experiences and best learning experiences of my life have come when I'm outside of it. So I recommend people see Avantageous. It's only going to take up an hour and a half of your life. And it's a science fiction movie that I think deserves a nomination for something. I think that we should give it some oxygen. So that's about it for that one. I'm going to take another break now, and I've got a little bit of feedback.
Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
Got a Facebook message from Tim Leiby. Thank you, Tim, for your support and also your Patreon support. Terry, I've been meaning to comment on something you said about Project Moonbase on Martian Drive-In podcast number 61. You expressed disgust at Hayden Rourke's General Green threatening to spank Colonel Brighteyes, feeling it was completely inappropriate thing for a commanding officer to say to his subordinate. I have, for some insane reason, seen Project Moonbase at least three or four times over the years. It kept cropping up on USA Network or Sci-Fi Channel late at night when I'm sitting up vegging or out at the office with the television on in the background while working. And I always got the feeling that the exchange was done teasingly to help establish General Green's paternal relationship with Colonel Brighteyes rather than any kind of serious threat. The way much of the conversation went strongly implies that he treats her more as a tomboyish daughter or niece rather than strictly as a subordinate, and her use of his nickname Pappy and the way she delivers it suggests that she considers him as much a surrogate father as a CEO. This is very much in keeping with how Heinlein wrote relationships between older authority figures and the younger female subordinates, and in the 1950s at least it would have passed by audiences as banter, spanking reference included, without eliciting much of a raised eyebrow. Of course, audiences back then wouldn't have known that corporal punishment was a turn-off for Heinlein, as his 60s post-discovery of sex books showed us, which is what helps make it really extra special creepy now, as do his frequent references to his nine-year younger second wife, Virginia, and her fictional analogues as the Little Woman. Yeah, thanks for that, Tim. Yeah, the 1950s were a weird fucking time. That's all we can say about them. So much that we now know is actually coverage for someone's proclivities did get passed through the media and Heinlein novels in particular quite extensively. But we can look at them from our point of view now and see the kind of shit that was going down then and call it for what it is to a certain extent. And yeah, I do realize that it was kind of done in a friendly and bantering manner. But there's also the fact that he was thinking about spanking her, which, of course, becomes another thing. Don't care if it was played by a gay actor. There's still something there which, through the lens of our increased knowledge of human nature, let's say, we get a totally different spin on it there. But, yeah, thanks for that, too. And thanks for the Patreon subscription. By the way, all the Patreon subscribers who haven't given me a list of the movies you want me to do on the podcast, please do so. I've got the book here, and I'm going to start hitting the list solidly next time. The only reason I didn't do it for this podcast is that Advantageous and Ex Machina came up on my screen, and I thought I've got to talk about these now while they're topical. So I apologize for the delays on the other movies, but I will do them. If any of you want to guest on the podcast who are Patreon subscribers or who I invite, I'll explain how this works. When you get guests on a podcast, you need to know that they're going to be able to talk well and they're going to be fun and they're going to be on the same level and they're going to take things in the right way when you're talking to them. The worst thing possible is to get a guest on a podcast who's not on the same channel as me. So what I've got to do is kind of shepherd that through. There are people I'm getting on the podcast who I know personally in FaceTime and in real life, and I'm going to be getting them on the podcast because I know they can talk about stuff and I know they've got enthusiasm for certain things. But I don't mind getting the listeners on as well. If you're willing to cough up the Patreon subscription and you want to be on the podcast to talk about a movie you're particularly passionate about, more than happy to do that. The passion will carry us through, if you know what I mean. If you're passionate about a particular one, we'll do it. Absolutely. Now, having said that, I've also got to apologize for the other aspect of things, which I will fix up this week. Been on holidays, just got back to work. Things are a little busy. I'm going to fix up the credits at the end of the podcast as well. I'm going to play the ones I've got this time, but next time around for the next Paleo Cinema podcast, I'm going to have the credits nailed. I promise that. So, having said that, I'm going to end it here. I do have some feedback for Paleo Cinema, so I'm going to leave that till next time. But anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Keep watching good films. Throw suggestions through the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. Friend me up if you haven't friended me up on Facebook. I'm more than happy to have as many Facebook friends as I'm allowed to. And thank you for listening. And I'll be back again in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, in another week with a Paleo Cinema podcast, and take care of yourselves. Bye.